Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs for an audience of entrepreneurs. And my goal has always been for people who are listening to learn something, to build something, and then to come back on here and talk about what they're building, to do an interview themselves. Joining me is someone who listened and actually did more than that. He sent me this thank you note, which I, when we talked about it before the interview started, I said, I bet I got it. And I had it in Evernote and I pulled it out. This is a note from 2014 that he sent to me as part of a Well, we'll talk about why he did that. We've stayed in touch over the years when he lived in San Francisco. We connected in person, and I've watched him go from being solid but not exactly figuring the path to suddenly like knocking it out of the park with the path. His company, I should say, you know what, I should introduce you and not just talk about you, right, Chandler? His name is Chandler Bolt. He is the founder of Self-Publishing School. It's an online education company that helps people write and publish books that help them grow their businesses. And I remember when I said to myself, this guy's like, he's nailed it. He's figured it out. It was at, I guess it's called Traffic and Conversion was the name of the conference, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Chandler's up on, I guess you can call it a stage, but it's not exactly a stage. It's where all these.
Oh, is that the unplugged stage?
Yeah. Was it? Yeah. Did you even have a mic?
What's that?
Did you even have a mic or was it literally unplugged?
I had a mic. I jokingly referred to it as the Pee-wee stage because it totally was. But I mean, it was awesome. It was packed.
They were good people. It was packed. I think a lot of people had a hard time maintaining the audience. A lot of speakers were talking and then they just couldn't shout over the cacophony of people who were at the booths talking. And so they couldn't get an audience. You not only had an audience, a big audience, but at one point you said, if you want this thing, and you made it sound so magical that everybody wanted the thing. And instantly a pack of people who worked for you came out with cards, with postcards, and everybody filled out the postcards. And then the pack of people came and got the postcards back. And that's when I said, oh my God, Chandler has got this operation working. This guy who was like listening to Mixergy interviews, sending thank you notes, working so hard. He's got it all dialed in. So I invited him here to talk about how he did it, to find out what sales numbers are, how he grew his business. And also since I believe we're in a recession, I want to find out how his business is doing in what I'm calling the COVID recession. We can do it all thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first is a company that he and I both use. It's called ClickFunnels. We use it to turn leads into customers. And ClickFunnels doesn't want me to tell you about how good their software is. Instead, they want me to tell you that if you're listening to this podcast, you'll probably like their podcast. It's called Traffic Secrets. And the second sponsor is a company that I use anytime I have an idea that I want to bring to life. It's called HostGator. And I'm going to recommend that you go to them and sign up using my link for a website with them. But first, Chandler, good to have you here.
Hey, good to be here, Andrew. So fun seeing this come full circle.
What's your revenue right now? Let's say last year, 2019. Yeah. We'll get into this year soon.
2019, we did 6.3 million net revenue.
Net revenue?
Like top line minus refunds.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Got it.
So and not false revenue, real net, real revenue.
And then bottom line?
Bottom line, about 2 million.
2 million. And you're the only owner in the business.
Yes.
Unbelievable, dude.
It's been a wild ride full of a lot of turns.
Wowee. So this card, when we talked before the interview started about the note that you sent me, you said it was part of a campaign. What was the personal project? What was that personal project?
Yeah, I need to bring this back. I like challenges. I am borderline challenger on the Enneagram, but I think I'm actually, are you familiar with the Enneagram at all? Okay. So it's like, you know, there's achiever, there's challenger, there's a bunch of other ones. I love challenges. And so there was one year I did 100 pushups a day for the year. And then the next year I did a thank you card every single day for the year. So 365 thank yous. And this is so funny. We were just looking at your thank you card. And what I mentioned before that I mentioned here is just like, I remember you sending a thank you card back and it just rocked my world. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this guy that I listened to sent me a thank you card back. And just, I think it instilled in me the power of like zig when other people zag and go analog when everyone's digital. And I could have emailed you and said, hey man, love the show. But just the fact of like, And that's what I found that whole year is you'd be shocked how many people sent me thank you cards for sending them a thank you card. It's like the most bizarre thing ever.
What? I've been wanting to do it only because there's so many people who've helped me. And I just have this sense, this need to say thank you in a more meaningful way than, hey, thank you. I've been wondering, like I've been thinking about doing something like that. I've been wondering, what did you get out of that? Did you get that spiritual wellness that I imagine will come from doing it every single day? Did something else happen? Did you get business out of it?
So much. I mean, I think for me, there was a couple of things. One of the biggest things was every day I had to think about who am I going to write a thank you card today? So naturally, you're on the search for things to be thankful for. Because if you don't have something, you got to keep thinking. Yep. And so it's like, so naturally, like there was that. And then there was all kinds of things like this. We didn't really know each other before that. Same with people like Hal Elrod and a bunch of other people who became self-publishing school's biggest affiliates, biggest supporters. They promoted us. I would speak on their stage. Like I can trace so many things back to that year and a lot of the deep, meaningful relationships that I have that are because of that. It's funny as we talk about it out loud, I'm like, I got to at least bring this back in some capacity because It's just this feeling, I think, of people all around you saying, oh, Chandler appreciates me in his life, which is, I think, something that I do a relatively poor job of communicating on a consistent basis. So it's just like a way to more consistently communicate that.
And this was before self-publishing school was up and running, right?
Yeah-ish. I mean, we had best-selling book system, which is ultimately what became self-publishing school. It was definitely not self-publishing school. It was kind of this kernel of an idea.
I was able to send you a thank you note back so fast because I had for years right here a stack of thank you cards. And I knew that if I had it handy, I'd be able to pull one out and write it to anybody as it came up. And truthfully, over the last couple of years, I just got out of the habit of doing it and it collected dust. So I got rid of it. But I've been thinking of getting it back and starting it up again. And it's interesting that you did that. You told me before we got started that you were listening to Mixergy just before you, was it quit school?
Yeah.
Why did you quit school?
Oh man, I got tired of learning how to run a business from professors who had never ran a business. That didn't make too much sense to me. And I was learning more by actually running businesses. So
What was the business that you ran?
Yeah, I had a couple in high school. One was a canteen through my entrepreneurship class at school. Second was a landscape and lawn care and pressure washing business. And that was like 10 grand in profit that I saved before going to school. And then the third one was in college, was through Student Painters. So College Pro Painters, College Work, Student Painters, kind of all similar companies. They teach you how to run a business by running an exterior house painting business. And so I was the number one in the company, number one in the country, my rookie year. So that business and that gave me the confidence. And then I trained three people the next year. And that really gave me the confidence to say, hey, I don't need this anymore. But yeah, it's full circle. It was the interview with Dane Maxwell way back in the day. Then I joined the foundation. And then Dane was one of the people I went to for counsel. And he was like, yeah, I'd probably drop out. I wouldn't recommend that to anyone. And that was the common thing that people kept saying to me is, I wouldn't recommend this for anyone else, but I think this makes sense for you.
What was it about entrepreneurship that drew you? Why would you, a guy who's smart, a guy who's already accomplished, why would you want to do that instead of get a job or even frankly wait to start a company? What were you looking for?
It's my parents probably. I mean, it's probably nurture, not so much nature. I think it's my dad runs a small town construction company. Mm-hmm. And my mom's a realtor. And so I think subconsciously I grew up seeing him. He could come to my t-ball practices. We could take a vacation or like whatever when my friend's parents couldn't. And so I think I saw that and just this bullheaded determination. They used to call me, my mom used to call me Boss Man Bolt. Because growing up, I just like boss kids around and it was super annoying, I'm sure, for everyone involved. But
it's
like,
just part of who you were, seeing your dad do it and all the upside of doing it. And you just had to get out there. It's not about the money.
I mean, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Like that's not the motivator, but I think it's a scoreboard. Okay. In some sense, right? Like it's not the scoreboard. It's one of the numbers on a scoreboard. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely like, I wanted to make disproportionate economic impact. I want to create something so that long after I'm off this earth, like the world's a better place, like all those things. But honestly, man, it was listening to shows like this and hearing people's stories like Dane and then Hollis, which is so funny. We just talking about that before the interview is like, I was like, oh, I could write a book. That's crazy. Hollis did it. And then, you know, listening to Dane, like, oh, maybe I could do that. And so, one of my early books, we talk about this concept of many, like a lot, M-A-N-Y, many, like small, M-I-N-I, many, many successes and how that builds confidence. And I think I'm a byproduct of that. It's like trying a bunch of things and failing a ton, but having a bunch of little wins along the way. And each time you have that little win, it's like, oh, what else can I do? What else can I do? What else can I do?
Give me an example of a failure that you had, one in the early days that was dramatic.
Oh man, one. That's tough. It's really tough to narrow down. Honestly, so many. I dropped out of school and I thought I was going to be the next Zuckerberg or Bill Gates. You know, I'm like looking at all these people dropping out of school and hey, I mean, never mind. They dropped out of Harvard, not like small college I went to. And about 16 months later, all my bank accounts were negative and I was about to fail at dropping out of school. And that was a big moment.
Because you did what? Where'd the money go?
I bet on myself and it wasn't paying off.
What's the bet that you made or what's one of them that failed?
Oh, I mean, it was the early days of self-publishing school, but I had about 6 months of runway when I dropped out. And then in 2014, that same year I'm writing a thank you card every day, I think I probably made 16 grand total. And so now so little that the government's like, hey, dude, you don't have to pay us taxes. You're good.
why didn't you feel like a failure at that point? By the way, this is around the time, am I right, where you wrote the book on
Productive Person. Yep.
The Productive Person. Here it is right on my iPad. In this book, you're a guy who's like, what, 24 at the time, who's telling people. Not even.
I wrote that book at 19.
Telling everyone how to be more productive, right? You're going off with, I got the answers for you. Meanwhile, you're not making much money. You're not making much progress. Right. Why didn't you say, I am such a fraud or a failure. I better go back. Why?
Yeah. I mean, I think I certainly considered that. I mean, like I wrote that book of like, hey, I ran the most successful company in the country and in the company for student painters while being a full-time college student, a young life leader, all this stuff like, here, it was just really for my friends that wanted to be entrepreneurs, but they were more wantrepreneurs. It's like, hey, here's how I did this. And then you go out in the world to do something else and you just get your butt kicked. Because there's a difference between like student painters is it's a franchisee type thing. And so it's like, here's the model. If you can work ridiculously hard, you'll succeed because we have the model. But then the difference is you go out in the world and it's like, okay, there's no model. But I still can work hard, but I got to figure it all out.
Right.
And so that took longer than I thought it would. And so there were a lot of times where like, maybe I should just get a job as a number two for an entrepreneur that's really doing well, or like all those thoughts.
Why didn't you do
my head. I think I just believed, man.
You still believed or was it momentum that you just had to keep going?
I think there was probably an irrational belief.
You still believed in yourself.
It was always around the corner, you know? Uh-huh. My brother, I don't know if you know this actually. My brother plays in a Grammy nominated rock and roll band called Need to Breathe.
Aren't they like a Christian rock band? Am I right in my memory of that?
Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't label themselves as that because it's not like exclusively Christian music, but a lot of other people would label them as that for sure. And it's kind of like a hybrid, like The Fray, I think is the closest model to that I could think of. But anyways, one of their songs it's called More Time, and the hook is, I need more time, just a few more months and we'll be fine. And it's about, you know, kind of about one of the guys arguing with his wife, I think is what the premise of the song is like. So think entrepreneur society, aka musician, significant other, same thing, right? Like, hey, I just need a little bit more time. I just need a little bit more time. And I think we've all felt that at times, but that was truly how it's like, it's just around the corner. It's just, if I can just keep. And so I'd borrowed money from my parents, my brother, and a friend, and that was it. And so I was like, we borrowed 15 grand and all my bank accounts were negative. So there's that. I mean, I bought out my business partner. Like, that was a huge
at that point
mistake. Oh no, no, that was a later. Year later.
We'll get yeah. into that. Why then did you decide I'm going to help people write books?
It was the one thing in my life that I felt was meaningful. And so I talk about this in my TEDx talk a little bit. Tell the story about my friend Kendall, and basically just he tragically passed away right in front of me on a cruise. Mm-hmm. And it was a rewards cruise for student painters. And that just changed everything for me. Like, my grandma also passed away that same weekend. And so I'm coming back from this cruise and my buddy just passed away right in front of me. And then I'm getting texts and my grandma passed away that weekend as well. And that just rocked me. And the night before he passed away, we talked about his 5-year goals, his next year goal, like his dreams, all those things. And just kind of this realization of, like, he was 20 years old. I was 21 at the time. He's never going to get to accomplish any of those goals. Now I'm living for two, because I definitely felt a lot of guilt and responsibility.
Because we were standing in the spot talking.
Yeah, it was like we were standing in a spot that we weren't supposed to be, and it was an accident. And like, I felt for a long time like it was my fault, because I was like, we did it every year, but it was like I was the one that was just rallying the troops, like, hey, let's go up there. And
where
and
was so this going? Up where?
On the mast at the front of the ship.
And so then it's like, what was it that turned stairs, around and got
but
him?
It's crew only. What's that?
Okay. And then what was it that hit him?
The sonar thing started mm-hmm. spinning while we were up there and swept around, hit him in the chest, swept him over the railing. And he fell 2 stories. And so that for me, man, that was like, that rocked me. And I realized there was a whole lot of things that I cared about that didn't matter. And there was only a handful of things that actually mattered. So I felt like I was living for two. And the big thing was when I had a conversation with his dad, and he said, you know, he said, hey, Kendall, he's my only son. He's the family name. I'm old. I can't have more kids. The only good that can come out of this is if other people's lives are positively impacted by the fact that this happened. And in my mind and in the space that I was in, especially at that time, I was like, that's the cue. That's me. Like, I'm responsible for this. And so that's like, you know, on the video, you could see this audio. You can't obviously, but I've got this bracelet. Says make him proud on one side, and the other side says WWKD. His name is Kendall. So what would Kendall do? And it's just a daily reminder for me. So that was where, and kind of bringing this full circle, Kendall had attended one of my random webinars and wrote the rough draft of a book. I didn't even know it.
Because at the time you'd written a book. This is one, this was the book that I just mentioned earlier where you said, I'm productive. I'm doing well in this painting business. I want to share with other people what I've done. That was so impactful for you that you said, I'm going to teach other people to do it. He went to one of the webinars. He learned, he had this idea that he was going to write a book. In fact, he made a lot of progress on it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so you said,
rough draft basically done.
God, I can't solve the problem of malaria, you might have said to yourself, or starvation all over the world. But what I could do is help get his book into the world and help other people leave their books behind. So when they die, just like when he's passed, their lives have meaning beyond them. That's it, right?
Oh, 100%. And his friends helped publish it. And actually, one of our good friends, like, is now my right-hand guy at self-publishing school. And at the same time, like, I had already worked with a cohort of, I think it was 44 people, and a bunch of them had already published. So I'm looking around in life and like, hey, what am I doing that's meaningful here? Like, if I were to die tomorrow, what is left behind? And so that was when I really keyed on, okay, helping people with books, like, this is the one thing that's meaningful. I'm going to trim pretty much everything else, focus on my family, focus on my friends, focus on my faith, and focus on helping people write and publish books.
You smiled so because
that was it.
You smiled when you said faith. One of the things that stands out for me, in addition to everything I said in the intro, which was fairly long, was you're such a smiling person. I remember seeing, you were giving me a ride to Tam Pham's home in South Bay.
Yeah.
And giving Neville Medora, the copywriter guy, a ride. And Neville said, this is the most happy-go-lucky person. I saw him and his dad like hugging and like, I don't know, like, loving on each other.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
two adult
we're riding scooters through San Francisco.
And then we talked about your brother a little bit, talking behind your back quite a bit. I wonder, like, how much does your faith, I don't want to get into a place where you feel uncomfortably personal, but how much of your faith makes you into this person who I see who's smiling all the time, who believes even when he has no right to believe because he only made $16,000 after quitting school to become Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, it's a big part, man. And to be honest, it's something I don't talk about a ton. It's one of those things where I feel like I'm always self-conscious about making people feel uncomfortable or like I'm judging them because they don't have the same beliefs that I do. And so I've always tried to create a space or environment where it's like people feel like they can come as they are with me as a friend or me as a human and not feel judged. And I feel like that's what's wrong with religion and stuff like that is it feels very judgment oriented, but 100%, man, it's been a big part of my life and has definitely helped me through tough times.
Why? Because I have you believe faith. God has something big in store for you, or because you believe that?
Yeah.
I
believe my God given gift on this earth is to run and scale companies that make the world a better place. And so I don't want to be on my deathbed and look back on my life and be like, I phoned it in. I didn't use these gifts that I was given for good. So that's like the through line I feel like of my life.
Okay.
But then there's also like, there's, you know, when the going gets tough, it's like, okay, like I'm going to leave this up to him and
truthfully, and he'll carry me.
I mean, as someone who's a type A, like,
yes,
I don't know that I've ever gotten fully to that point, okay, but I lean on that spectrum.
Got it.
Yeah.
Even God can't like take full control. It's like, I got the responsibility. You don't need to do everything.
I would like
here.
To get into a place where that is where I'm at, but it's very hard for me.
Okay.
Because I believe that. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, Kagan said some of the filthiest things I've ever heard people say. I could never repeat them. And still, when we talk in private, he tells me about this personal, spiritual, religious practice that he has in his head that I don't think I could do justice. And it's his thing to talk about, but it's like a sense of gratitude and request for power. Do you do something like that? A practice that's unconventional that we can learn from that helps you?
That's a great question. I wouldn't say it's untraditional across the board. I mean, I meditate, I pray, okay. There's like things like that where it's only non-traditional if you're not a Christian or if you don't meditate. Like, I wouldn't say it's like, oh, this is unique to me.
Okay.
Meditation and reading and prayer are probably like three lines.
Reading a spiritual book.
No. Sometimes the Bible, sometimes faith-based books or things like that, but just reading in general is very centering for me and as is
every day
meditating.
I've been thinking about starting my day with read. You do every day. You start with 100%. The book.
So I'm a big Miracle Morning guy. So Hal Elrod is, I think, one of the most inspiring people that I've ever met. And he's one of the biggest supporters of self-publishing school. He sent us more customers than anyone ever.
Wow.
That book changed my life. So I'm actually in his
Miracle Morning change your life.
Oh, 100%, man. So that I started my Miracle Morning beginning of 2014. 2014 was the hardest year of my life. And I've done it pretty much every single weekday since then. I would be hard pressed to find a weekday that I haven't done at least an abbreviated version of the Miracle Morning. And so there's the reading, there's meditation, there's some form of exercise. He has a couple other things that I don't do as much. It's affirmations. I listen to my affirmations. Okay, that's probably unique. I listen to affirmations every single morning.
You record into your phone.
I recorded my own version and then my brother recorded a version for me. So I listen to myself telling myself how awesome I am. And then I listen to my brother telling how awesome I am.
Let me ask you to take a dangerous move here.
Yeah.
Hit play on that for us. Hold it up to the mic. Hit play. Would you do that?
All right. Yeah, sure.
All right.
Sure.
While he does that, I'm going to tell everyone who's listening to me, if you're out there and you want to start a business, if you want to start a website, I urge you to go to hostgator.com/mixergy. I had this guy who taught my kids about zoo animals. I said, do you want to start this thing where you charge students, where you charge parents actually, to let their kids come into your class? He said, I would love it. I said, you know what? I'm going to set it up for you. I went to hostgator.com. Within minutes, I was able to set up a whole website for him. Now, not only can he teach students in this class that he does online, where parents are paying just a few bucks to let their kids come in and get direct questions and answers, see his animals and so on, but he has the ability, because it's a website, to put up a page that says, if you need birthday parties under lockdown, I could do it. If your Girl Scout needs somebody to come in and teach about animals, I could do it. And the reason we know that those are two interesting things for him to create is because people followed up and said, hey, I like what you're doing for these classes. Can you do my kid's birthday party via Zoom? So anyway, opportunities come his way. He can add to his website with more and more pages. That's the beauty of having HostGator as a hosting company. Super inexpensive, easy to get up and running. It doesn't have to be the most dramatic business on the planet. Like, you don't have to be the next Zuckerberg. You can just get started and then build and build and build. If you use my URL, you'll get the lowest price they have possible. You get a simple, easy, fast way of getting up and running. And you'll be tagged as a Mixergy customer, which means I'll appreciate you and we'll always have your back. So all you have to do is go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. I saw you hit mute because you were hitting play, Chandler. Let's hear. I'm really
all right. And I'm going to give just a disclaimer. This is going to be very embarrassing. And this was recorded in May of 2017. And I've been meaning to re-record it for probably at least 9 months. So this is my personal affirmations to myself. Okay, here it goes.
I'm going to make $1 million in 2017. God gives me blessing and favor in everything I do. I make everyone's life around me better because they're in a relationship with me. I'm confident and decisive in all situations. I'm a great leader. Girls love me and are lucky to date me. I can get any girl I want, and my wife is going to be a 10 out of 10 in all areas, challenging me to be the best version of myself. I live life on my terms and have fun along the way. I stay positive in all situations. I take time to stop and smell the roses, traveling and spending time with people I love. I trust and empower my employees. I love giving, and it's a huge part of what I do. I remember everyone's name after the first time they tell me. I'm making Kendall proud every day. Today is going to be a great day.
That's it.
Wow. Do you feel like you've crossed off some of those items and so it makes the rest feel more powerful?
That's a great question. Probably subconsciously. And I think that's the big thing, right? If we're talking law of attraction,
yeah,
get a little woo-woo for a second. Like, the theory there is that your subconscious is the most impressionable right before you go to bed and right when you wake up. I think that's Think and Grow Rich. And if that combined with, I think I got the record your affirmations thing from the Ultimate Sales Machine, Chet Holmes. And so for me, I listen to that right when I get up while I'm taking my retainers out, brushing my teeth. It's like the first thing I hear. And so it's every morning and it's I am statements or it's affirmative statements. So there's the cognitive dissonance in your brain.
Feel like when things weren't working out for you, it's like, oh, this is such a fake. It doesn't work. Did you get cynical and pessimistic about it?
No. I don't think I ever got cynical or pessimistic. There's definitely your brain is like fighting that,
right?
That it's not true. But I think that's the whole theory from like the law of attraction. It's like, that's the whole theory. It's like the cognitive dissonance, like your brain will work to make it true out of some sort of disbelief and feeling of like, and all of these almost without exception were things I was actively working on and actually wasn't good at. So like, I remember everyone's name after the first time they tell me, like, I mean, it's still, that one's a work in progress.
Okay,
For me, it was like, I was bad at remembering people's names.
Often enough that is fairly true now. It's fairly true. Do you feel it's helped?
I think it's definitely helped. Yeah.
You know what? I like you more now that I've heard that. I don't know what it is. I think I've gotten in your body, in your soul somehow. And
you're like one of the only people that have ever heard that. That's so funny. I think I've only ever played that for maybe like a friend and my girlfriend. And now here we go.
And now everybody. And posterity. All right. So you did this first version of teaching people how to publish books. Every time I ask you about that, you almost dismiss it, that's not the real thing. That's not self-publishing school. What worked about it and what didn't work about it?
Oh, I mean, I think a lot worked about it, except for the business partnership. The success rate was really high. We had 44 people. I think over 60% of them wrote and published a book within 6 months.
How? What was your process for getting people to actually take action, to do the work?
Yeah, it's funny. I think I probably learned this on Mixergy on the Dane Maxwell podcast. It's sell then build. And so we sold before we had the product because I made that mistake previously and I sunk a bunch of money. I built the thing that no one wanted.
What was that?
It was a productivity course on the back of The Productive Person.
Okay.
Spent like 10 grand, you know, did a build a funnel for you, kind of done for you thing. We did this. We went in a studio, recorded all the videos. We never asked customers if they actually wanted it, and they didn't, turns out. I don't know if you've sold a single copy of that.
So right from the beginning, you said, if you're going to be in this program, I want you to reach out to whatever audience you've got and sell some books.
Oh, sorry. That was confusing. No, I sold the program before creating any.
Got it. And you created.
Yeah.
Who'd you sell it to?
It was 44 individuals that said, and it was very clear. Yeah, we did a weekly webinar for 3-4 weeks. I had two partners, I think, like affiliates.
Okay.
Jamie Tardy and James Shramko. I will forever owe them.
They're really impressive people. Jamie Tardy, especially, has got a really good big audience. Yeah. And at the time, she was like one of the few people who had the weight, the ability to convince people to do this type of thing. How did you get her to say yes to you?
Yeah, those guys are the OGs of the internet world, right? And I met them at events and probably wrote them a thank you card or multiple. Actually, I just interviewed on Jamie's podcast finally, like a few weeks ago. And the one thing she said is like, she's like, I remember you kept sending me gifts. And she's like, my kids still have like some of the gifts. And it was like that gift guy. And so I would send her a thank you note or like some sort of gift. And I did that a lot.
Intentionally trying to get to some deal or?
I think probably in the back of my head, but it was never quid pro quo or whatever.
Okay.
Like it was never tit for tat. That's not how I roll, or at least that's not how I try to roll. Inevitably, like I'm human, like that's going to come up. It was very much like, hey, I'm just going to build this relationship. And this is someone I really respect. And at the end of the day, it was, take a chance on me, and worst case scenario, I'm going to knock the socks off of everyone who shows up for this webinar, and you don't make money, but like they're pumped and they appreciate you.
Got it. So, and like, she's someone who's also, I just happen to know her better than some of the other people we've talked about, but I happen to know that she's just really, she's on it. She wants to make sure that she's only partnering with the right people. She's anal about the details. In a way that I've seen you be anal about the details too. Okay, so that's how you got customers. What happened with this partnership? We brought it up a few times, but I didn't delve in.
Yeah. So the three became two and the two became one. And so it was really, there was a bunch of lessons learned there. For me, it was there was three of us, and two of us felt like, hey, we're bringing a lot here. The other person isn't. We need to buy out, renegotiate equity, any of those things, but this isn't working. We were unable to come to an agreement, so
like you were doing a lot, but no one.
No, there were two of us, and I just don't want to name names because I don't throwing people under the bus. But there were two of us that said, "Hey, we feel like we're bringing a lot of value to the table. You're not so much. So either perform or adjust equity."
Okay,
it's super simple, right? In theory, but when you have people and emotions involved, it's a lot less simple.
What did you do with the other person who,
So we said, finally we reached irreconcilable differences. We split the money and we said, you keep the name of the business that I created, the logo that I created, blah, blah, blah. You can't keep the content. You got to recreate the content. We'll go recreate this. So that's what we did. We recreated Self-Publishing School. And then that was when we did about 1.1 in the first year, and we were off to a really strong start. And then, you know, about a year after forming that, showed up to my my company offsite and found out from one of my employees that my business partner was trying to kick me out of the business.
Wow, why? And,
I can only theorize. Looking backwards, I think he was my boss at Student Painters. And I think that's really tough. When I was the CEO of the company and I was the face of the company, I think naturally, and I was probably hard to work with because it's just like very hard charging, very much. Well, we had just different values. I wanted to scale a big company and he wanted to have more of a lifestyle business. And so naturally I'm like, hey dude, like I brought the money to start this business. And I am working like way harder than you.
I want to understand a little bit about equity. Well, so he wanted to push you out. You eventually ended up owning the business because you bought him out.
Yes. So okay. I found out that he wanted to kick me out. I confronted him. We went through mediation. We negotiated a buyout. I went multiple six figures in debt, borrowed money from my parents' retirement, my brother, wow, and Hal Elrod, actually.
Wow.
And it was like, I cannot fail. My parents' retirement's on the line. So there's no option and I had to turn around the company. I had to fire a bunch of people. Like, we were hemorrhaging money. Like, it was a very tumultuous and tough time. But
where was the money going?
We overstaffed too fast. And it's like the classic early entrepreneur problem. I feel like where you get attached to the vanity metric, which is you go to a thing with other entrepreneurs, like, oh, cool, how many employees you have?
That is such a really big question. Right.
What they're really asking is, how much money are you making? But they don't have the guts to ask you how much money you're making. So they say, how many employees you got? And they kind of like do some rough math and say, all right. And so we felt
math.
Like employees were representative of growth. And so we got, as my parents would say, growing up in the South, we got too big for our britches. We were just hemorrhaging money.
Okay. The other thing that I'm curious about with you is, all I see is a relaxed, smiling person from you. I don't pick up on a little shred of stress or anger or anything. But I've interviewed people for jobs who interviewed with you or worked with you, and it seems
they said
like
he's
you're like,
very intense, probably, right?
There's a sense of admiration for your order. If it was intense, yeah, or like a pain, I would have brought it up. I have no issues with that. But there, it's like you and Brian Harris are the two people who I know who have structure down to like the bottom detail.
I love that guy.
Right? He's amazing. I feel like you have the same thing, but with him, I have more insight into his process. With you, I wonder, what is this? How do you operate? How are you keeping things functioning so systemized?
Yeah. And I think that's very jarring for a lot of people because they see my personality and it normally does not match up with someone who cares about systems. It's just like, oh, this happy go lucky, like more face visionary, mm-hmm, whatever. This company is not going to be like your ops guy. But I think, and I 100% wasn't, because I'm like the guy who has ADHD and was on Adderall at one point and like dropped out of school and like all that. So I definitely lean that way. But I think early on, I realized if I do not figure this out, this can be the bottleneck for my ability to grow. So I had to learn to love systems, learn to love playbooks, learn to love process.
That's what it is. It's systems. That's why people say he's so organized. Everything is done just right. And do you actually live by these systems?
Oh, 1,000%. So I have this thing. It's a podcast and it's a YouTube channel that's kind of just like a fun little side project, but it's called Seven Figure Principles. So there's like the Seven Figure Principles podcast and the Seven Figure Principles show. And that's like, the goal of that is to train up my internal employees, number one. Mm-hmm. It's to answer entrepreneur buddy questions that people always ask me. And then it's to recruit new talent. That's really it. There's nothing to sell there.
By showing your process, people understand
exactly
how to work with you. Okay.
So it's like how to hire your first salesperson, our A player hiring process, how to create an org chart, how to hire an assistant, like all these things that people would just ask me about because they know that we do them well, or we have a system or a playbook or process or whatever. I just started recording them and it's been a lot of fun. It's kind of fun to work on content that's not like, oh, cool, here's how to write a book, now sign up for self-publishing school. It's like everything is like geared to that. It's kind of fun to just have this side thing that's like, yeah, look, yeah, there's nothing to buy here. Just watch.
And so when I saw you at Traffic and Conversions with those people who are handing out postcards, that was all based on some checklist that they were following?
That was the early days. So I learned that from Pete Vargas, and he's been a huge part of teaching me the speaking side of things. Mm-hmm. So funny hearing you say that, man, because I think there's a big lesson in there for people, which is the story that you're telling yourself versus how people are perceiving it. Because in my mind, that was one of the first times that I ever gave a talk. I stared out at the audience, which was freaking packed. And I looked out and it was all people I'd looked up to and learned from for the last few years. And I felt like I just bombed. We did like, there were a bunch of contact cards and all that, but it's just so funny. It's like, there's always someone on the other side that's We get
I literally took a video of you doing that.
I remember that. I think you said
did I tell you that I did that?
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
because it was amazing for you to tell the audience. Did I do what?
I think you sent the video to your wife and were like, you can't believe this. And then you sent it to me or something.
It was, yeah, because it was so, it was such a tough room. No one paid attention. It was the worst. I don't know what they did. The only thing I can think of is that Ryan Dice had an extra corner. He figured, I'm going to bring my people in and give them some space. Let's see what they do with it. Who cares if it doesn't work out? He's not charged. Did he charge you for speaking there?
It was a sponsor benefit.
But, okay.
Yeah.
So I had this sense that it was just a, let's just add it, but it wasn't a really good room. You made that room work, but your people also gave a sense of, I don't know, the way that they, the sense of order that they had. Didn't they have t-shirts too? That
right. Bright yellow t-shirts that said, let's talk about your book.
Yeah. I might have even spied you guys later on, like huddling together. So was that a process that you then systemized for the next time? Even 100%. That goes by, it does.
Oh yeah. Now we are very dialed in. And so we have our event. Yes. 100%. So that year is the year that we went from zero to we did a little over $1 million. In revenue from speaking. And before that, I'd really done pretty much no speaking.
Because you're selling at the speaking engagement. When you say $1 million, it's because people who fill out those cards end up coming to you to get.
Yeah, they'll sit down with my team at the event. They'll talk about their book, their strategy for their book. If it makes sense, they'll sign up for self-publishing school. And that's how we did. I think that year was like, on average, like $32,000 per event in revenue. And none of that was speaking fees, pretty much. It was all, it's not pitched from stage. So it wasn't like, that's not really like, I'll do it. And I have done it, but that's not my bread and butter. It's more like, hey, if you like this, fill out this card, talk to my team, book a time, sit down, talk about your book. We'll talk about self-publishing school. And so that's kind of the model. But I think if we were to pull a lesson within a lesson, and this is, I think, a through line for why we've been so successful at self-publishing school, is, and me personally, is one of our core values is fail fast, fail forward, fail often. So our goal in pretty much anything is just fail as fast as possible and learn and iterate and improve. So that I like that stage was like not a failure, but it was like definitely a lot of it's like, okay, cool. The slides sucked. Like I wasn't as prepared as I should have been. I got stage fright. Like, and a bunch of other things, but we learned.
How do you iterate on that? What's your process? Do you go back to a checklist and fix it? Or do you just talk with your team and you say, okay, now we have a better understanding?
Yeah. I mean, for me, that was a unique presentation that I've never given before, which I pretty much not never do that, but I want to practice it as a webinar first, because that's a lower risk environment. And it helps.
You're saying next time you knew, don't start off with something 100%. Brand new, do it at least as a webinar. Let's get it out there
and
first.
Build Got confidence, it? Right? Like I'm doing this, like it was like a 20-minute speaking slot in a super noisy room and I am blocking the slides. Like the projector is projecting on me and the wall behind me. And so I was just like, and I look out in the audience and it's like all people I've admired for years. And so I was just a bit shook. And so that there's that, then there, but there's all these little things like that same event we spoke. My main talk was afternoon of day three and a bunch of people left and didn't attend the afternoon of day three session. So every other session was packed leading up to all the sessions at that time. So now part of our SOP is if we're going to go speak at an event, it need preferably morning of day one, because that gives my team the maximum amount of time to meet with people while at the event. I'm fresher in the morning. We preferably need a break immediately after so that they can hand in their cards, get free books, book times with my team, all that stuff. Like there's just like a checklist.
Yeah.
We need to make sure that like we can get this, and this. It's a minimum of 30, 45 minute slot. There's a minimum of X number of attendees. How much did they pay to be there? What's the overall goal of the event? Is the goal to sell some other product?
And you want all those things in your checklist.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, for sure.
Right, let me talk about, I want to come back and ask, how did you get people to write a book when you were just getting started? Do you have extra time? I know we started late and we're running late.
Yeah, okay, great.
Second sponsor is a company called ClickFunnels. How do you use ClickFunnels?
It's so funny. That's what the talk was about. The little talk was about free plus shipping book funnels. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how we use it is for our free plus shipping funnel. It's
why
one
do
of the
you
highest
instead
converting
of WordPress
funnels.
Or any other thing?
because they do a really good job of making it super easy and simple and, oh, and a two-step order form, which really helps conversion rate. And so there's a card abandon sequence that we can send people in. A bunch of
because
stuff.
They step one is simple. Give me your contact information. Step two is now yes. pay. If they don't pay, there's a sequence. And you use exactly. their email to do the follow-up?
We don't use their email. We integrate it with everything that we do.
Yep.
But just the two-step order form is really hard to execute off of ClickFunnels. It's really good. And the out-of-the-box template, it just looks great, man. Like it's a well-formatted page. It yeah. converts well. From a two-step order form, like it's very easy. The sales page is slick. It's clean. You've got the OTO, which is also hard to do on other softwares.
What's the OTO?
So the one-time the offer. Bump. But I actually misspoke order bump. Yeah, so yeah, it's exactly what you just said. That's what I meant to say. And you get the order bump, right? It's like that smooth. Then you got the OTO, the one-time offer on the thank you page. The free plus shipping funnel, it's legit. And that's one of our highest converting funnels. That's why I believe in writing books and using it as the free plus shipping funnels, because it just converts. And
ClickFunnels. Well, I'll say anyone out there who wants to give it a shot. Yeah, ClickFunnels does that too for Russell Brunson, the founder's books. If you're out there listening and you want to try ClickFunnels, go to clickfunnels.com/Mixergy and you'll get to use their software for free. That's clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. And the podcast that they actually paid me to talk about, not the software, is it's called Traffic Secrets. And if you're looking to learn how to get traffic to your site for free or paid, Russell's a great storyteller and he'll teach you how to do it. Just look for 100%. Traffic Secrets, the podcast. So how did you get people when you were starting out? You had 44 people. How did you get them to actually write their books?
Yeah, good follow-up. So it was the sell, then build, and then teach them exactly what they need help with. So the whole concept is we were very candid. Is, hey, I've done this before myself, never taught it successfully in other people. If you purchase, you're going to get the highest touch, like highest attention, you'll get my personal cell phone number. We'll do weekly coaching calls. We'll do weekly group coaching and we'll do the content. And then we just ask them like, hey, what do you need help with? And I had my VIP students who had more access and paid a little bit more out ahead. Like they were usually 2 weeks ahead of everyone else. And so I just said, any video you need, any training you need, anything you're stuck on, just tell me and I'll create it. Well, it worked out that we dripped out the lessons 1 week at a time over 12 weeks, and they were usually ahead. So they'd tell me what to create, and then I just roll it out to the rest of the class like a week or two later. So we did that. I did one-on-one coaching 30 minutes per week for 12 weeks.
And with everyone who'd gone through the program?
With our VIP students. VIP, yeah. So me and one of the other business partners split the calls. And so I'd block off Monday, and it'd be like 12 calls back to back, 30 minutes or whatever the number was. And you know, I'd do that. And then we had a group call, which was like part inspiration, part Q&A. So we'd bring in a student and we'd say, hey, what's one thing you're struggling with? And like, what's a win? And so it's like, there's this feeling of camaraderie and like, oh, they're doing it, I can do it. And then we answered their questions for everyone to see and answer everyone else's questions.
What about life gets busy, sitting in front of a blank page is, and I know you've written about this, but sitting in front of a blank page is a challenge when life is busy. What did you do to overcome that? You can't just reach over the computer and help them type.
I think there was a feeling of community and external accountability, which that's part of what people, I feel like even to this day, people pay us for. I always joke that it's a mix between Indiana Jones and Jillian Michaels. It's like Indiana Jones, we blaze the trail and show them what to do. And then Jillian Michaels, like we whip their butt in gear and like hold them accountable to actually do the work. So I think knowing that with that,
how do you hold them accountable?
Coaching calls, the community. I think we've sent you one of these at some point, like a little SBS box. Yeah. Yeah. And maybe you notice in there, it's like my rough, there's one page. It's like my rough draft will be finished by date. So it's like, write that in, take a picture with it, share it. So kind of forced external accountability. So now all their friends are holding them accountable, and accountability buddy, like pairing systems and just like a bunch of stuff like that. But also it was like, I said, for the 12 weeks, I'm like, hey, I don't want to deal with scheduling calls with all these people. So we're going to find a time that works, and we're going to do that exact time every week for 12 weeks. So and you show up and
it.
You've got questions. And I think I was a mediocre coach at best because I was very hard on people. And I don't think I was as loving or nurturing as
people like
probably
that.
Many of them needed. But, you know, just holding people accountable. And honestly, it was following a lot of the systems, coming back to that theme, that I learned from student painters. We just implemented a bunch of that, but for this type of business model. Because it's like, we figured if you can get a 18 to 22 year old to run a $50,000 to $100,000 painting business in a summer and not just go get drunk all the time, then, you know, you're really onto something. Right. And so we just took a lot of those accountability rhythms and expectation setting and, you know, a spreadsheet where they have to report green or red, whether they hit their goal for the last week, and like just a bunch of simple stuff, but frameworks and systems that were taught to us that we just said, hey, let's apply this for something like this.
One of the things that I admired about you as an entrepreneur is you don't just do online sales, you also do phone sales. And yeah. I hear about that all the time. I just interviewed the woman who runs Fat Merchant, and they do credit card processing. They're growing phenomenally well. I said, how fast do I get a phone call if I fill out one of your forms? She says, within minutes. There's a human
being.
No
way.
And I said, I'm realizing a lot of the more advanced companies have actual salespeople. 100%. I don't know anyone in online education who does that. It's not like a Skillshare has got a salesperson calling me. What's your process for figuring this out? Where'd that come from?
Failing a lot.
So what did you do? Take me through the story of how you got a sales team.
Yeah. So, man, my process is always like who versus how. So who's figured this out, not how do I figure it out? And if I can figure out the who, then they know the how. And so when I first got started, I'm like, all right, who's done this? All right, Tony Robbins, John C. Maxwell, Dave Ramsey. So like, what do they call their salespeople? How do they comp their salespeople? What does their process look like? And then I just called a bunch of people and asked about them, or I think maybe a couple times I asked about them, but then everyone I knew who ran sales teams, I was just like, hey, how do you do this? And so I'd do that. And then I read every sales book that I could get my hands on and then hired two sales reps. Cause that was advice I got is don't hire one. You got to hire two, because they'll compete. And you don't know what the bar is if you just hire one, cause you might think that's amazing and it sucks, or you might think that sucks and it's amazing. Right. So just, you have kind of a, you know, it's like one's a data point, two's the start of a trend, kind of.
And so it's like, and you hired experienced people or new salespeople?
I hired experienced, and I actually hired one from John C. Maxwell, and I hired one from Gym Sales. And the one from Gym Sales just killed it. Like I what I didn't realize at the time, this is kind of like the classic, this is why this is a core value, fail fast, fail forward, right? Because you learn stuff in your failures and in your successes. Is I didn't realize at the time that Gym Sales is, you're selling transformation. What we're selling is transformation through the form of a book. They're selling transformation through exercise. So it was actually a very similar sale, even though it doesn't seem like it at all. And because that person was used to like, oh, I'm slinging $50 a month gym memberships, like they have to have a high velocity, high motor, which works well in an environment for us because we get so many leads. We've got so many calls. Oh my gosh. it's ridiculous. Wait,
what's the process then? How does somebody end up on a call with one of your salespeople?
Yeah, it's kind of a lot, but we'll get upwards of 600 leads a day. And
600 a day?
Yeah. Yeah.
On your site?
A lot. Yeah. Different channels, but yeah. And it's a lot. And a lot, you know, only a small percentage of those folks will book on a calendar themselves. About 40% of those folks will automatically what we call DQ or disqualify and pull off the sales calendar.
Okay.
Reroute through what we call an SDR, sales development rep. We have four of them currently. They do about 50 to 70 outbound calls per day. And so they're calling the people who got canceled, as well as our hottest leads that don't book a call by themselves. And we bubble up to the top, the hottest leads for them so that they can just call through, a lot of which are the free plus shipping funnel book purchasers, because those are some of the hottest leads, webinar watchers, things like that. And then the reps, they have about, usually their calendar is about 80% full when they wake up. So they wake up, they take 1 hour phone calls that are paced for 45 minutes so that preferably they have a buffer to either between calls or to objection handle, things like that. And they'll, so we have probably, 40 or so qualified appointments booked per day. And so a bunch of appointments being completed. And it's a machine that is probably about, I'd say about a 7.5 out of 10 currently. And we're continually trying to make better.
That's a really far advanced system that you've come up with. So fast.
It just keeps evolving. And that's one of our other core values is hard work and continuous improvement. And so well, we believe in working hard and continuously making things better. And so, we started with something that was very basic and we just continue iterating.
So why would somebody want to go to selfpublishingschool.com and write a book? I looked at my notes from when we started and I asked you, how can I describe self-publishing school in a sentence? And everything was expected. Online education company, help people write and publish books. And the last part was not, that help them grow their businesses. How is a book going to help someone grow their business? What's the point here?
Yeah, I get really fired up about this. So, I mean, I believe that book is one of the best things you can do to grow your business. And we focus specifically on three things: using a book to get more leads, more sales, and more referrals. And so what I mean by that is like more leads. So these are more people that heard of you because of your book, right? So let's use Russell Brunson, for example, right? Traffic secrets. Dot-com secrets, expert secrets, whatever. Like that's a whole group of people that would have no clue about ClickFunnels if he wouldn't have written those books, right? So more leads, more sales. So we use a book as part of the sales process so that the higher percentage of people who already know about you end up doing business with you. So we use this as part of the sales process. Oh. And so I give them away like their candy. And so you saw this at work at a speaking event. So we'll go, and it's a value prop to the event host, because we'll say, hey, we're going to give away $5,000 worth of books and 300 books or whatever. And we give them away. So when people handed in those cards, that's why they all handed in their cards, because they wanted a free physical book.
And they get a book right away, right there.
Yeah.
What does it cost you to give away a book?
It's cost just recently went up, but I think it was about $3.15.
Okay.
Or $3.50. We'll call it $4 landed. And so it's a huge value prop, but then in the online space, register for the webinar, you'll get a free copy of the book. We put the book everywhere, because the book is it's mostly, this book, my book published. Mm-hmm. This is like the 10,000 foot view of what we teach. Right. And so that helps whether they read it or not. And any sales mechanism goes up because you're the perceived authority on that thing because you have that book. And then the third thing, referrals. I believe, and we do this, is we give, it's like, what if you gave 2 copies of your book to every new customer? Or if you wanted to take it a step further, every new prospect, and you say, hey, here's 1 book for you, and here's 1 book for a friend who struggles with XYZ or who needs help with writing a book. And so now all of a sudden, like if I give you a business card, you're going to throw it away probably within 24 hours. If I give you a book, you keep it. It's on your desk, in your office, in your home, whatever. You might not even read it, but someone comes to your office and say, hey, what's that? That looks interesting. You're like, yeah, I've never read it. Here, you want it? And so you're just enabling people, turning customers
so
prospects
much over the years, and I felt
first.
Guilty about it, but you're saying that's part of the plan. I will have 100%. People send me their books. I can't throw away a book. So I leave it on my desk for years. It'll just sit there in a pile, right? And occasionally people will come in and say, why do you have this 1 book? And if it's a few books, I might display it kind of nicely. Yeah. So it doesn't look like it's trash sitting on the desk. And I get it.
Yeah. So that's how we look at it. It's like a book is a business card, and really a book is the start of the conversation. So we have people all the time. I mean, just to use the events as an example, I know that's not totally relevant for everyone, but it's just an easy example. Then is what we're already talking about is, we'll have people, we'll give them the book. They'll read it on the plane ride home. They'll book a call when they get home with my team. They'll sign up for self-publishing school. Happens just about every event we go to. Mm. So it's just a way to start the conversation, bring more leads, sales, referrals.
All right. Anyone who wants to go check out the site itself, here, I'm going to give you 1 negative piece of feedback. It's the site.
Remove the dash.
Yeah, it's self-publishing.
We own both.
School.com. You do. But yeah. I get an error if I go to self-publishingschool.com without the dash.
If you do, that needs to be fixed.
And I love that you got the, like, that. I saw the after. Look on your face as I said that. It was like, such a, oh no, we got to fix it. You want to be smiling to...
So we own selfpublishing.com and we redirect that to
that,
self
yes.
dash for SEO purposes. We also own selfpublishing.com.
You do?
So that's a different property. Yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna go to selfpublishing.com. So if you go there,
that's a totally different property.
Got it. Self-publishing by Self-Publishing School, the number one resource for self. But if anyone wants to really see your stuff,
oh yeah, it's selfpublishingschool.com,
right?
Yeah.
What I like about you is school, self-publishing. There it is. Self-publishingschool.com. What I like about you is I just like your style. Like, I look at pages all day long of people who I'm interviewing, who I'm going to interview. It's just a little too crowded and overwhelming. There's a sense of simplicity, but completion that comes from your work. Does that make sense?
I appreciate that, man. I feel like our brand used to suck because I'm not a low aesthetic person.
What do you mean? You don't like a lot? Because you have bad aesthetic taste, bad taste.
I don't think I have bad aesthetic taste. I think it's not something that I care about that much. So, like in when I'm prioritizing, I'm not like spend 5 hours to make the website look great. It's like that's not like I'm more an X's and O's kind of guy.
I would have thought it'd be the opposite because I'm looking over your shoulder and exactly over one shoulder there's a nice logo framed of Self-Publishing School with it just looks good. With the graduation cap, yeah. What I was trying to say. On the other side, there's a definition of impact, also nicely framed. The mic is in the right position. You're centered on camera. The camera height is properly adjusted. How many people do I talk to who are looking down at their computer, which gives this impression that they're not fully there? But you're saying that's not, you always have your shirt really nicely ironed. Do you iron your own shirts?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
So I think a big lesson here, Andrew, is like, and not to insinuate that I'm above doing that by any means. But I think a big lesson here, Andrew, is like hire for your weaknesses. And so this is like, I knew if it were me, I would be in a white room with one poster on the wall, right? But I paid someone and I said, hey, decorate my office so that it looks good. So she did all this stuff. And same thing with the website. It's just like, I feel
Where'd
like
you find somebody to do your house like that to make your office look good.
It was a friend's wife who loves doing that. And she's like, yeah, she loved it. And so it was perfect.
That makes sense.
And she was a huge help. And trust him, right? It's like, I don't know. She was like, hey, do you want me to do this or this? And I'm like, I have no idea. Like,
so she had you're the doing posters
this
printed
I suck at this. Oh, yeah. She came up with this leveraged impact. That's, I talk about that in my TEDx talk. That's like a big concept that we talk about. So it's like, all right, you got a core concept. You got this. If I move out of the way, you've got focus, follow one course until success. That's a, like big thing I'm passionate about. And then just like kind of nice looking picture.
And then what's that animal on the other side of you?
Cheetah. So she has spirit animal. It's like cheetah, move fast, all that stuff. So that was the inspiration. But I mean, I think the big thing is know your weaknesses and hire your weaknesses. And I was just listening to an interview yesterday. So good. With the CEO of Shopify. And he was telling the story about how an early investor said, hey, I like you. I like your company, but everyone here is just like you. You need to learn to hire people that are different than you. And I think there's areas where I still need to improve on that. And I think that was also like, it's kind of one of those weird things where like, I feel like I've done that pretty well, but I also still have a good bit of room for improvement. I feel like early on, it was, I recognized that as like, I've got a bunch of people that are different than me that you wouldn't think like, oh, that's not Chandler. And so there's different perspectives and stuff like that.
What's the name of the guy who set this interview up? I told him, I know Chandler, we can do this together, but I don't think
Pedro.
It's a good fit.
Yeah.
What is his name?
Pedro Matos.
He was so good. I said, I don't think it's a good fit. I got this other thing going on. And he came back and goes, totally fine. By the way, here's this thing, how it connects to this other thing. I said, yeah, I just can't do it right. And I go, totally fine. But if things change, here's the other thing. Finally said, you know what? This actually would be stupid for me not to do it. That's the thing. I forgot about it. I was so busy, like focused on you. We got to end this interview. But the COVID thing, you guys have done better after COVID recession hit than before. Why?
There's so much. I mean, I think it's, the fundamentals. Like we are a business built on fundamentals. Therefore, we haven't been, we keep solid cash reserves. We don't overhire. We like all the mistakes I've learned.
But he said even sales went up.
Oh, after. Yeah. I mean, we had a record month last month, and we're about to have maybe not a record month, but very, very solid month this month.
And is that because advertising rates have gone down or because people are now going online for education much more?
I think it's a combination of two or three things. Really good people, really good team. They are just kicking butt. And my team has just very much responded. Like my big challenge to them when all this started going down is I said, hey guys, months, years from now, we're going to look at this and this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to us. My question for you is how do we get better because this happened, not in spite of this happening? And so we're going to get more disciplined. And so we came up with a theme for the quarter. It was back to the basics. And so it was, if it doesn't have to do with getting customers signed up or getting customers results, we're not doing it.
I thought that's all you did.
That's like the two fundamentals of business, but like there's all this other stuff that you're like, it's just a focusing question, right? Like, We stripped out a bunch of non-essential tasks. We just asked is this the highest leverage thing that we could do to get new customers or to get customers results? If the answer is no, then we just kept stripping. So I think there was really good people focused on student results and focused on like the fundamentals, blocking and tackling. We cut a lot of non-people, non-essential expenses. So my goal was we're going to trim as far as we can non-people. And then the people will be the last thing to cut if we have to get to that. So we contingency planned. We said, and I think that's where a lot of people got caught is they didn't contingency plan. So it's called greater black planning. So it's like, you have to look at like, okay, if we miss this, then we're going to do this. If we drop revenue by this, we're going to do this. So we did that. And then I would say the last thing is all of our content marketing efforts that we were building for years just popped off. People were at home and they're writing a book. So they're Googling and they're ending up on selfpublishing.com, on self-publishing school, the self-publishing school podcast, YouTube channel, like all those metrics went up. That combined with our biggest objection for all time has been, I don't have time to write a book. And so my sales team like really leaned in and they're like, hey, you know what? Actually, you do. It's the best time. You got nothing but time. And so that we were very fortunate with that we were able to just lean in.
I've known you now for so many years, not super well, but better than most. It is impressive to see how far you've come. I will consume your little Facebook posts when they come up. I don't always hit the like because I'm just kind of lost in this thing. It's just amazing to watch. You stay focused. You keep improving. Yes, you stay this like nice guy who's going to send people thank you cards. Like to this day, you're still smiling as I'm saying this, almost like a 14-year-old smile, right? Like, complete. I'm here. I'm good. I got this, right?
Not every day, but I try to most days. And I mean, I'm an intense guy. Like,
I haven't seen. I still just see, at times I see a glimmer of it. I would love at some point to do an interview with you on the intense systems that you have operating your company. From what I've heard, you have become a really freaking good manager of like, you organize your company in a way that just makes sense. There's some people who just, you know who it is? The first time that I knew the Tim Ferriss over a decade ago, that I got Tim Ferriss was I asked him random questions. He had organized, thoughtful responses. And I realized this is a person who I understand why people turn to him for guidance. He's an organized thinker. The same thing with your company. I understand why people come to you for guidance. You're an organized manager. And I've seen this throughout. All right. I got to shut up. I get no commission from doing this frankly. There's no benefit to me other than I just have to talk openly. I said something really painful to one of my past guests where it doesn't matter. I don't want to get into it so people don't know. He sent me a thank you note this morning. He said, you know what? This thing actually really helped me change the way that I think about life. I said, I've been pained that I said that to you in the interview. I'm glad that you took it well. But I try when I get in my interviews to just let go of any restrictions on myself and be open as possible. I'm glad that that came out in a positive way this time, not a negative, so I don't have to feel guilty about it. Anyone who's listening should go check out selfpublishingschool.com and my two sponsors. Really, I'm grateful to them. If you're looking to build a website inexpensive and really effectively, go check out hostgator.com/mixergy. And finally, ClickFunnels has a fantastic podcast you should listen to as a follow-up to this. It's called Traffic Secrets. Go get it in whatever podcast app you listen to me. Thank you so much for doing this, Chandler.
Andrew, thanks so much, man. This has been a blast. So cool seeing this come full circle.
Thank you.